I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Hey, it's Srini. Before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about something new that I am really excited about. We're going to be doing our first live taping of The Unmistakable Creative in New York City on August 9th. If you're interested and want to purchase tickets, you can just go to unmistakablecreative.com/live and it will redirect you to the event page. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/live, and we look forward to finally meeting you in person. Jonathan, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Srini, for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I mentioned to you before we hit record here, actually stumbled upon your work by accident in one of those late night Google searches where you search for one thing and it sends you down a rabbit hole of links, and somehow I ended up on your author page on Amazon and was just kind of blown away, not only by the book reviews, but what your work was about. And so I immediately ordered a copy of your book and read it rather quickly. So I am very thrilled to have you here. But before we get into that, I think I want to start by asking you what I feel is a very relevant question given the nature of your work, and that is, where in the world did you grow up, and what impact did where you grew up end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
All right. So first of all, let me tell you that I am excited to be on your podcast, and I think that the kind of people that are listening to your podcast are my tribe, creative people and nerds. Mm-hmm. And the kind of people that go on a Google search and find themselves 3 hours later not knowing where the time disappeared. Yeah. So that's us. So my name is Jonathan. I was born in a small village on the outskirts of Jerusalem, Israel, which is where my accent is from. Uh-huh. And my parents were born in Russia. So they emigrated to Israel, Jews from Russia. Growing up in the Middle East, in the Holy Land, is something that is very unique. And I would say that it definitely influenced who I am. It kind of forced me to be a peace activist. I guess if you're born here in the region, you're either forced to be a maniac or a peace activist. That's how it influenced me. And as far as art and creativity and stuff, how did it influence me? I guess that would be a longer answer,
which I'm happy to talk about, which I would love to hear. Actually, so
how did being born in Israel, I think, the biggest thing that influenced me creatively and that made me an entrepreneur, a self-employed person, an artist, an author, whatever you want to, all the titles. The biggest thing that influenced me was not so much the place in which I was born or the society to which I was born. It was mostly my mother. Uh-huh. She is a tough cookie. She is a crazy woman. No, seriously, she's amazing. Without much money, she raised five kids, all of whom I find very successful. And she basically, never bought us, presents or gifts or whatever, but used the money to further our education. So she would send us to different classes, and she would, from the age of 9, 10, she would encourage us to work, like to actually earn money. And she would praise everything that we do as if we were, Michelangelo's and Jean-Paul Sartre, and the most important, when I was on the stage, she would marvel and say that I am the next Tom Cruise. And she was just very, over the board, positive, never said a bad word about our performance in school. But she expected us to excel. She thought that we were the incarnation of God on earth. Like, very interesting, towards all the five children. So so being born to such a mother kind of forces you to think highly of yourself, and to not want to minimize yourself or to shrink yourself, or to, you know, play it small. You really want to play it big because you know that back home she expects you to, you know, to be the leader in school and to be the leader in the theater play and to be the, you know, the best in whatever it is that you choose to do. So yep, I would say that that's the biggest influence on me.
Wow. Okay, five siblings. One, what birth order are you? And are your siblings like you in terms of their creative interests? And then the other piece that I'm wondering about is, you know, having grown up in an Indian family, obviously, you know, I think we share some interesting similarities in terms of cultural values with Indians and Russians, because I've had people of Russian descent here. And I have found that there's almost a sort of overachiever mentality baked into the way that we're raised. Is that, did you find that to be your experience as well?
Well, I guess a few questions here to answer. So first of all, I am the middle. So I'm number 3 out of 5, which is, you know, it has its own advantages and disadvantages. I think it made me realize, not realize so much as become a bridge. So I kind of, in my personality, I like to bridge between groups, like the older two and the younger two, and Israelis and Palestinians and artists and non-artists. I like to bridge and to explain and to kind of, you know, to be the mediator. Mm-hmm. As far as Russians and Indians, first of all, I'm interested to know about you, Srini. How many siblings do you have?
I have one sibling, and she's a doctor.
Mm-hmm. And where were you born?
I was actually born in India, but grew up all over the world. Australia, Canada, Texas, then Southern California.
Mm-hmm. So I would say that, yeah, for sure there are similarities between Russians and Indians and Jews, and etc. But I would say that one of the biggest gifts and challenges that the child can go through is being an outsider and being a child of immigrants.
Uh-huh.
And, the more biographies that I read of successful people, the more I come to the conclusion that in some ways you have to go through your parents, you have to go through difficult stuff. And being a child of immigrants, you know, you're being planted with the seed of, you know, so for me, personally, my parents always had an accent. Mm-hmm. And Israel is a place that, you know, it's so funny, like 60 years ago, 70 years ago, everyone had accents here, right? Because everyone basically were immigrants. So everyone, you know, all the Jews that came here in, you know, in the end of the 19th century and the 20th, beginning of the 20th century, you know, were all from Russia and from Egypt and from South America, and so there was always an accent. Because of that, I guess Israel is kind of, you know, very sensitive about accents and is really trying to create this new Israeli Jew. And that led to Israel being kind of frightened of accents and of multicultural. I'm sorry to say that. But basically what I've experienced as a child with my parents both having a very thick Russian accent is that people kind of looked down upon them. And I would see how my mother, who was very proud at home, would go into a store with me, and how the seller of the store, whether a woman or a man, would kind of put them down or at least disregard my mother just according to her accent, just due to her accent. So that made me, being a child of immigrants, want to like rebel and to like, hey, you guys, don't mess with my mama, mm-hmm. you know? And to want to prove and to want to be the best in order in some ways to kind of to pay for what I felt was a little bit of a societal discrimination, I guess.
Yeah. What were the early experiences that really shaped your interest in creativity and being an artist? And, you know, I think having grown up in an Indian culture, one of the things that I think has always been interesting is that we are very early taught that creative careers or creative thought, you know, the things are wonderful as hobbies, but they're not good things to make careers out of. You know, my parents drilled that lesson into me pretty hard when I was thinking about being a music major in college and in the high school band. And I'm glad my dad talked me out of it because, you know, you only have one tuba player in every major orchestra and you usually have to wait for somebody to die for a job to open up. But I'm wondering, you know, in your experience, has that been the case with Russians? And also, are your siblings, artists as well?
So, I would say that my siblings are kind of each is pretty good at whatever that they do, and I think that what my mother tried to do very much, and my father as well, even though she was, you know, she wore the pants in the family. So what she tried to do was to recognize something good in us, beginning, you know, in kindergarten, and to harp on that and to develop that. So my older brother is in the arts. He is doing visual arts, like computer-based visual arts. And my older sister is into education, and my younger sister is into law. And my youngest sister is into entrepreneurship. So she has like two businesses. And I think that when it came to me personally, I think my mother saw that I was an introvert, a shy boy, very timid, late to speak. So it took me until the age of 3 to begin articulating words. And even then I needed to have the help of a speech therapist at one point in elementary school. So I was very shy, very timid. When, you know, in the kindergarten, when we had the recess, when we had the break and all the children would go and play outside, I would prefer to stay inside and to, you know, draw or to play with the dolls. I was also very feminine. So I think, my mother really tried to encourage whatever she saw. And I'm going to sound a little cynic, but I don't think she saw much. This is funny because I'm very full of myself and I'm very confident of my abilities. And I think I'm an amazing artist and an amazing author. And I think I'm pretty, you know, I like myself. Uh-huh. But I think that she created something out of not much. So it was a Pygmalion effect. Yeah. She really, she saw that you know, I wouldn't be good at sports because I was very fragile. I wouldn't be good at whatever, you know, required social skills because I was very timid. I was kind of small. She began telling the kindergarten teacher to allow me to stay during the break in the kindergarten and to draw. And she would praise, my mother would praise my silly doodles as if they were nothing short of the Mona Lisa. She would talk about them and she would tell me, oh my, like today she's doing the same for the grandchildren. So she's an actress basically. And she's a kindergarten teacher herself. She's been a kindergarten teacher for 30 years as a professional. So she's good with children. So from the age of 4, 5, 6, she was nurturing me being an artist. And I think that what she realized is that even if I want to be an artist, it would be good for me to feel excellent at a specific field. You see what I'm going at here?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think that many parents today, you know, are doing an amazing work trying to kind of give their children many skills. And I think especially in the States, I see mothers, you know, driving their daughter from this activity to that activity and to, you know, from sports and to, which is great. But I guess what my mother did was to focus on a very narrow thing called drawing. And by the age of six, she hired a private teacher. You know, we didn't have money basically. So I you know, it's a miracle to find how she was able to hire a private teacher. But he would come to my house once a week or twice a week, and he would sit with me. And again, she's a very opinionated, strong-willed woman, my mother. And she forced him never to say a bad word about my drawings, never to correct my drawings, always to praise me, and to basically draw next to me. So she told him, you know, he told her, look, I'm not a teacher. I'm an artist. She basically found him. He was an immigrant as well, and kind of trying to make a living selling his drawings. And she told him, I want you to be a teacher. And he said, I'm not a teacher. And she told him, that's great. I don't want a teacher. I want you to just come and draw and paint next to my son. And he drew with watercolors, and then he drew with oils. And I just kind of copied. And that was my initiation into the art world. And I don't think it could have been any better, because I was basically lucky enough to learn from a master, from a very successful, like not successful as far as the business world goes, but this artist was very successful in his technique, like most Russians are. They have very good technique. Right. So I was just a witness to see an artist at his work, and I think that's a huge thing. And honestly, I think that most of education, and you know, you told me before we began recording that many parents are listening. So I would say that one of the best experiences for your child would be to become an apprentice. Uh-huh. So to, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, I just finished reading the great biography by Walter Isaacson. And da Vinci was at Verrocchio's workshop, an apprentice in his teens. And that's how you become a da Vinci, in my opinion. You really need to become an apprentice. You really need to, to assist someone who is better than you. Throughout my life, I've always tried to apply this principle, which I learned at age six, to all of my endeavors. And I would say that one of the reasons why I've been successful in different fields, so I've been, you know, I'm afraid to say that because I don't want the audience to judge me, right, for being too full of myself. But I have had tremendous success. I feel very honored and lucky to have had very good success in the acting field, like the drama and theater and television in Israel, and then in visual arts, painting mostly, and then in the last 3 years in writing. Like I'm selling thousands of copies of my books each month, which is pretty incredible within 3 years of just, you know, delving into that industry. So, and I would say that it's not about me and it's not about my talent. I would actually say that I'm not talented and I do not believe in talent, which I think you've read in the book, Masterwork. I'm very suspicious when it comes to talent. But I really believe in finding a wing to climb under. And in every field that I'm trying to conquer, I am learning to emulate the best in those in that field, and often to befriend them. And I think that that's one of the keys to success. Amen.
Wow. You know, a lot of things that came up for me. I'm really glad that you brought up the fact that your mother was a kindergarten teacher. You know, we sort of danced around the edges of it. You mentioned apprenticeship, and I couldn't help but ask you what your current views are on our current educational system and how it needs to be updated. You know, what role does creativity play in it? And even as an artist, how do you think about educating your own kids?
So first of all, this question I is one of the my favorite ones. I believe that I spend hundreds of hours pondering this very question. First of all, I do have a daughter who is 2 years old. Her name is Sarah, and she is delicious. I love her. I eat her. She's just the cutest and sweetest thing. This is something that I'm definitely thinking about, right? So I think that our current education system sucks. It's horrible. It's horrific. And I think that the teachers are amazing, beautiful souls, angels. So notice the differentiation that I'm doing here. The system sucks, but the teachers are amazing. If the teachers were given a better system, they would all shine. It's just that, you know, it's a factory really of grades and stuff like that. It's a very sad system. So first of all, I wrote a book, 600 pages, but it goes really fast because it's not a nonfiction, it's a fiction book. It's called My Beloved Helen Keller. And it's going to also be published in the future under the title The Teacher. But currently it's published under the title My Beloved Helen Keller. And it tells the story of Annie Sullivan, who was the most famous teacher of Helen Keller, the deaf, mute, blind girl born in 1886, I believe, or 1880. And her teacher was just the most remarkable woman ever. And she wrote a lot about education and how education should look like. She actually wrote essays and gave speeches, Annie Sullivan, which we don't know her. And most of us think that you have to invent the wheel and that, you know, what was true 100 years ago isn't true today. But I would beg to differ. She, in many ways, is my hero. She took an unruly, savage-like child who could not speak nor communicate with the world, and she was able to teach her how to read, write, communicate. Did you know that Helen Keller graduated from Harvard?
I did not.
See, most people don't. All we know is about, you know, her being 6 years old and, I don't know, learning how to say water and stuff like that. Like, we don't know much about Helen Keller. But basically, Annie Sullivan, who was an uneducated woman, was able to bring forth the spirit of one of the most amazing women in the 20th century. And I would argue in the whole entire story of humanity as we know it. So Helen Keller is an amazing woman, and behind her there was Annie Sullivan. And let me just share with you a few principles that Annie Sullivan discovered. She discovered that there is no use in having classes. There is no use in you know, trying to kind of take the world out there and to compartmentalize it and to have certain hours for certain chores, etc. You know, she had the advantage of having only one student, so they were one-on-one. So you may say that that's impossible in the current education system, but I would argue that it's very possible. Are you familiar with the Khan Academy?
Yeah, definitely.
So Khan Academy is the most important, you know, source that I think that, you know, the parents can use if they want to keep up with the Joneses. So if they want to make sure that their children have good grades and stuff, Khan Academy is the place to get good grades and to learn in the child's speed through videos and stuff like that. It's a very good tool. But I would say that the best way to educate and to educate for creativity and to educate for entrepreneurship, because I think that creativity is being an entrepreneur, and being an entrepreneur is being a creative, risk-taking person. So I think these qualities are really important. And the way to do, you know, the way to become creative and the way to become risk-taking, so having the entrepreneurial skills, is through trial and error, is through being out of school. So I don't know if I can, but basically my understanding is that by the age of 10 or 11, I would not want my child to go to school anymore. But to go and become an apprentice, like Benjamin Franklin was a printer apprentice, I think by the age of 12. And like basically everyone who was successful was an apprentice, in my opinion. And all of the, you know, the nerds that eventually took over the internet and took over different computer industries and stuff, they were encouraged to experiment from a very young age with computers and with technologies. So basically, my hunch as a teacher, as an educator, as a father, would be to find something that is interesting for my daughter, and to encourage her, to keep pushing her, to keep nudging her to do more of that. But I'm terrified of schools. I'm still at the age of now 32, unlearn. So I'm still working on unlearning and erasing many of the stupid things that I learned in school. So, yeah.
This episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Daniel Wellington. Daniel Wellington makes these beautiful watches that come in four different styles: classic, classic black, classic petite, and dapper. And all the styles have the ability to alternate straps. Sometimes they vary based on the design. The options they offer right now are NATO, which is fabric nylon, leather, and mesh. And I personally love these watches because they're stylish and they match with everything. And they even make great gifts. So if you have somebody who is graduating from high school right now or graduating from college, this might be a perfect gift for them. And if you want to see some of the Unmistakable Creative team's favorite combos, just visit danielwellington.com/us/creative and use the promo code creative for 15% off of your first purchase. Again, that's danielwellington.com/us/creative and use the promo code creative for 15% off your first purchase.
I knew that I didn't want to get out of this conversation without talking about the fact that you are a peace activist, because that really caught my attention. And the things that I thought were interesting is that there's almost a sort of strange paradox, right? Because in Israel, military service is mandatory, from what I understand, and it's what you do after high school. So how does the idea of being a peace activist coexist with the fact that you have mandatory military service? What did you learn from your time in the Israeli military, and what misperceptions do you think that those of us who are only witnessing what goes on in the Middle East via media have about the region?
Oh, each question you ask, Srini, is like an encyclopedia worth of. We all have misconceptions, and we all have misconceptions about the region, and we all have misconceptions about soldiers. So let me begin by saying that soldiers are the sweetest people you could possibly find. Like, they really are good people, very caring about one another, and that all soldiers, Americans, Israelis, all soldiers are, in their hearts are very good people. And I think that part of becoming a peace activist, truly a peace activist, so after reading a lot of Martin Luther King's writings, Mother Teresa's writings, and mostly Gandhi, I actually wrote two books about Gandhi. So excellent, really fun, fast reads that are fiction. So one of them is called 6 Days with Gandhi, and the other is called Dear Tolstoy, Yours Gandhi, about the mentorship between Gandhi and Tolstoy. And they're both really easy to read and fun and interesting. So Gandhi basically argued, and I would argue as well, that we are all sweet, 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 good souls. We're all really good people. And that you cannot fight fire with fire, and that only love can extinguish hatred. And basically, the Middle East is a place in which there is lots of hatred, unfortunately. And one of the things that I learned early on is that when you bring together people from both sides of the conflict to do something, to experiment, to have fun together, then slowly and surely all the divisions fall. So that happened to me. I was very afraid as a child of Arabs, like extremely afraid, because I understood that it was due to Arabs that I was finding myself by the age of 5 wearing a gas mask in a protected room, hearing sirens and hearing missiles falling. It was the Gulf War in 1990. And that was my childhood, basically. So the first time that I understood who Arabs were had to do with me, you know, seeing my mother and my father being frantic and worried, and hearing my baby sister crying and feeling like I don't have air to breathe within the gas mask, and all of us confined within a small room. Very, you know, very distressing. So by the age of 12, I kind of figured that Arabs were to be distrusted, that they were mean, that they hated me personally, that they hated my family and my people, that they should be, if not exterminated, that they should at least be, you know, moved or pushed out of the region. So when I was 12, I was told by this art teacher that I had, another art teacher, and she told me that there is this art weekend for youth. And I told her, well, that's very nice, but you know, my mother, we don't really have the money for this kind of stuff. Usually, you know, these kind of workshops or weekends or camps, they cost a lot of money, so we don't, you know, I was never to one of these things. So she told me, no, it's actually funded, so it doesn't cost. I was like, doesn't cost? That sounds odd. Where is it? And she told me, well, it's near Nablus. And I heard the word Nablus on TV as being a place with Arabs that is very frightening. So I told her, you know, there's no way I'm going. And she told me, no, it's actually really safe. You know, there is security there, and you get to paint with Arab kids. It's really fun. And I was like, no way. I want to live. I don't plan on dying. I don't want to die. But she, as being my teacher, really pushed me and was really into me going. And eventually she was able to convince me and to convince my father and my mother. And so it happened that at the age of 12, I climbed on a bus in Tel Aviv with a bunch of frightened 12-year-old Jewish Israelis. And we took the bus, and the bus with security took us all the way to Nablus, about an hour and a half ride. And there awaited us something like, I don't know, probably 50 Arab Palestinian kids. And we were frightened, like so frightened. But we were encouraged to come out of the bus, to come down and to join the kids. And soon enough, within 2 hours of guidance, we were beginning to draw and paint together a huge mural. And we had all kinds of sweets and fun food and stuff. And we had all kinds of activities. And by the second day, I discovered that, you know, that these Arab kids weren't about to kill me. Like, they really didn't want to kill me. And that really was a meaningful experience for me. It really was a meaningful, eye-opening experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And then on the other side of that, this coexists with mandatory service in the military. And you know, I've only read things about the Israeli military and you know, heard about it on TV. And from what I am told, it is probably one of the most elite groups of military professionals in the world. What did you learn from your time there that you have applied to your life going forward?
So it will be a little odd what I'm about to tell you. I learned that I never again want to be told what to do. That's what I learned. 3 years, man. 3 freaking years. 36 freaking months. 36 months and a day. I'm telling you. I counted. That's a long time, man. And to be told what to do, where to eat, when to wake up, where to guard, to climb on a stupid structure, cement tower, and to guard for 6 hours in the middle of the night, scared shitless, scared that, they could shoot me easily, terrorists could shoot me in an easier way than I would have shot them. Mm-hmm. I was a target. Basically, whenever you wear those green uniforms, you become a target. It's better, for Israeli haters. So for terrorists, or you can call them freedom fighters, but it's easier and better for them to hit green uniform wearers than civilians. Mm. And so you basically you are a walking target for 3 years, and you are constantly being told what to do, and you cannot read during when you guard. So for 6 hours, you cannot listen to music. You cannot be on your cell phone. You can just, I don't know. So, and I would get caught for reading a book, and then I wouldn't get in prison, but I would get in sort of not going back home for 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, all kinds of crap like that. So when February 6th, 2008 came, and that was my last day after 36 months and one day, when the day came for me to leave the army base and to bring, to give them back, the uniform and everything that was on a loan, right? And to give, my army boots and my doggy tag and all of the socks and the bag and whatever and everything. And when I walked out, I was like, man, never again is someone going to tell me what to do. Mm. So it sounds funny, but those 3 years were to me what for someone who has an entrepreneurial skills to be 20 years working in a corporate job. Mm-hmm. So take 20 years of someone, of a boss telling you what to do and what not to do, and people evaluating you, and you giving reports and asking for a raise and all kinds of stuff like that. 20 years, and you really shrink them, you push them, you shove them together. You get 3 really intense years of not being, basically being at work all the time, not going home much, right? And that taught me that it will never happen again. And basically from that day on, I was, from the age of 21 or 22, I was never an employee. Mm. And I've always been self-employed. And I think that for me, for my own personality, it's one of the best things that happened. So I think that that's the blessing that that resulted in me doing 36 months and one day of a service in the Israeli military.
So as a peace activist, do you agree that military service should be mandatory for all Israelis?
No, I think that as a peace activist, all militaries in the whole world should be annulled, should be canceled. I think that all weapon factories should be closed immediately. So basically the weapon factories, it's a big industry, the arms industry. And, people in the States are, concerned and surprised about mass shootings and mass killings and stuff like that. It's only natural to have mass killings when you have weapons. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with the weapon? Eventually you're going to use it. Yeah. So if you make 1,000 weapons a day, eventually someone is going to use it. So basically I think that weapons are it's an invention that should be traced back. So it should be canceled, I think. So I would be against armies, and I would be against all kinds, you know, all these things. For me personally, when I was 19, and I was already very involved with Arabs and peace activism, because, you know, that experience at the age of 12 in this art weekend camp really changed me. So that led me into, from one thing to another, I became a very active boy in an Arab Jewish youth movement, and then in all kinds of cool stuff that you don't hear about in the news, because you think that all we do is kill one another. But there is a big movement for peace within the Arabs and the Jews of the Middle East. So I took part in most of the organizations. But by the age of 19, I felt and really wanted to become a part of Israeli society. I really wanted to enable myself to one day go into politics. I really wanted to have my doors remain open to me. And my understanding at the age of 19 was that not going to the army would close many doors to me and will stop me from being able to, you know, to eventually go into politics or to go into anything within Israeli society, because Israeli society is very much surrounded around the army and a mandatory service for women as well, right? Uh-huh. So so that was the decision that I received at the age of 19. And now at the age of 32, it's kind of difficult for me to imagine, but I do not regret going at the age of 19. But right now I probably wouldn't have gone.
Yeah.
I would have rather, spend some time in jail instead.
Mm. Do you think in your lifetime you will see the end of this mandatory military service? And are there people who actually don't go and just leave the country?
There are a few people that don't go and leave the country, and there are a few, I'm not sure about numbers, but there are people also who decide to refuse and then they sit in jail.
Wow.
But yeah, courageous people. I'm very impressed with them. Do I think that in my lifetime the army will be abolished? It's my hope. It's easier for me to imagine that there will be peace in my lifetime than for me to imagine that the army will be abolished. So I do believe that peace is going to come, and I do believe that it's going to come in my lifetime. I do think that there will still be, you know, by the end of my life, I think that there will still be some sort of a body of people that are being paid to carry weapons and hopefully to only protect rather than attack. But yeah, I'm very optimistic. I'm very extremely optimistic. Every year another school opens in Israel for Jews and Arabs. So there are schools throughout the country, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, the north, the south, that are called Hand in Hand. And that's something that wasn't there 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But now more and more people are believing that we don't have any other option. We don't have any other option than to live together. So there are actual like schools, and they're opening, and they're very popular, and they're, you know, it's people send their children to these schools. So that's a big deal. And that just shows us that we're in the right direction.
Well, I think that makes a really sort of perfect segue to start talking about your work as an artist and your work as a creative, because this is probably the thing that caught my attention the most in the book was when you said, I envision a future in which people are more creative, and let me tell you what it leads to. More happiness, less suicides, less violence, less wars, more cooperation, more ideas, more literacy, more employment, more creative ideas to protect and nurture the planet, more peace between nations, neighbors, and within oneself.
Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
Are you definitely serious that I wrote?
Every book I read, I underline passages, and then I take each book after I've finished reading them about a week later, and I put everything into Evernote, all the things that I've highlighted, especially if I know I'm going to be talking to somebody. And to me, this was such a perfect segue to start talking about your work as an artist. But where did this notion that creativity will lead to all of these things? Not that I disagree with you. I completely agree as somebody who has just written a book about creativity for its own sake. Where did this idea that creativity could lead to all of these things come from?
I'm still a little flabbergasted. It sounded so good. That's so fun. If you can in the remaining time, I would love to have quotes. I'm like, because you see, I've written by now probably 15 books that have been published, and I have like three more books that I haven't had the time and courage to publish yet. At least three, if not four. So I don't really remember what I write, you know?
Yeah.
Where this notion came from? I don't know. It's obvious to me.
Yeah.
It's obvious to me. Creativity, it's obvious to me. It's like it's almost obvious to me. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, it was that to me was probably the most poetic package of the entire, the poetic line of the entire book. That was the one that I Instagrammed and shared, and I thought, oh, this is so beautiful. I want to talk about this notion of creating a masterwork and what goes into it, because I think you gave us some very profound both career and life lessons ranging from, lessons of managing our own psychology and our self-worth to actually doing the work itself. And I want to go back to something that you said earlier in our conversation about the fact that you had this sense of tremendous confidence in your own abilities as a writer, but then you also just said there are a few books you haven't published yet because you haven't had the courage to. How did that confidence develop? Is that something that you developed over time because of your skill, or do you feel that you developed the skill because of the confidence?
That's such an interesting subject for me because I wrote a bunch of books. One of them is about creativity. Another book is called The Art of Loving Myself. And another book is called The Fear of Success. Many of my books are about the books that I looked for. I was hoping to read, and when I found that no one wrote them, I read them, right? Mm-hmm. So this book that you've read, Masterwork, is what I wanted to hear. And it tries to instill and to plant this confidence in the reader as a creator, and to really explain to the reader that all of the masters were once amateurs. I think that Emerson said that every great artist was once an amateur. Now, as I'm talking to you, I remember that the book has lots of quotes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like between every chapter, there's a couple of quotes, right? Okay, good. So what's so funny, Srini, is that there is a bipolar quality to me or an ambiguity or an ambi quality, so a dual quality to me. On one hand, I really am very committed to what I write and what I create, and I really believe in what I do. And on the other hand, I always feel like it sucks and it's horrible. And why would anyone read it? And it's a struggle for me to this very day. Can you fathom, can you really like understand that I have an amazing confidence, and at the same time, I feel totally inadequate and embarrassed each time that I publish a book. like seriously, like hyperventilating, quick heartbeats, dry mouth kind of physical experience. So I'm very embarrassed about the books. I don't even, I find it really hard for me to even open them. Mm. So I guess the thing that I'm proud of is of choosing to deliver. I think that Steve Jobs said that artists deliver. I try to deliver, and I try to deliver products that are as good as I can get them at a certain point. And when it came to paintings, so for about a decade, I made a living from selling my paintings in galleries around the world. And those paintings were good. They weren't, you know, I would tell you that they were the best that I could do. And I remember one artist friend coming to my studio and saying, you know, this painting is good, but the composition is a little problematic. And I would look at the painting and I would tell him, you know, you're actually right. And if I were to do it again, I would move the tree a little bit to the right, and I would move the house a little bit to the left and put the landscape in the horizon, like more centered, but up. And he would tell me, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what you should do. So paint over it or correct that one. And I'm really proud of having developed this following attitude. Hmm. And this attitude is, you know, I'm not going to touch it. The next painting that I'm going to do, I'm really going to apply everything that I've learned, and I'm going to create a better composition. But this painting is this painting. I'm delivering it. I'm selling it. Bye-bye. Cheers. Bye-bye. And next painting, I'm going to get better. And that's one of the things that happens also with my books. Uh-huh. I, and you, Srini, as well, you can spend days and months and weeks and years perfecting your book and your book cover and your book blurb and your blah, 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 blah. But what I've learned is that, you know, the three words, aim, ready, aim, shoot, right? Ready, aim, shoot. Yeah?
Yeah.
So it's better to ready, shoot, aim. That's how we should do, how we should go. Ready, shoot, aim. So just like shoot. I'm like, so I'm willing to publish a book even when it's not ready, and to get the feedback, and then to publish a second edition and to make it better, and then a third edition and then to make it even better, and to keep learning, to keep running, to keep being on a race. So my recommendation to you, Srini, and to everyone who is trying to either write a book or to, you know, be creative, is to deliver. It's good enough. Deliver. And it's only your first book. This is only your first exhibition. This is only your first CD. Don't confuse your second CD and your first CD. These are different things. Don't try and create your second CD when you haven't released your first. Like, release the first and know that it's going to suck. You're going to be so embarrassed of it. But in the same time, in 20 years, you will kind of be, you will have reminiscence. You will kind of look at it fondly. And that's, I think, one of the qualities that I was able to learn. So again, I don't find myself being extremely creative. I don't find myself, I don't judge myself as being extremely talented. But I think that one of the qualities that I've learned to admire in myself is the ability and the willingness and the courage to deliver even when something isn't ready. And this is good for me to talk to you, Srini, because I'm hearing what I'm saying at the same time. I'm listening to myself. I'm like, yeah. Because I have, you know, three or four books that are waiting, you know, for fine tuning and stuff like that. And one of them is a book that I wrote 3 years ago about money, uh-huh. The history of money. It's an amazing book, but I'm embarrassed of it. I don't think it's good enough. So I'm like, man, Oh man, Jonathan, wake up. Deliver it. The world needs your creation. The world needs your books. So that's something that I'm trying to learn myself. And again, you know, publishing books, knowing that there are still typos in them, uh-huh. and knowing that they can, you can still like improve the structure, and knowing that the cover is not the best cover. Like really, many of them change covers or between the different editions that I published. It hurts. It really feels like giving birth. Like I remember when my wife gave birth. It was painful. So, basically, what I've learned is to go through the pain faster, not to try and postpone the delivery, but to just go at it and to you know, let it out, put it out there. And really, I think that only now, like after 15 books, I think like I'm only now getting better, you know?
Mm-hmm. What is your average day like? What are your daily sort of habits, rituals, routines that enable your working process?
See, if you asked me about 4 or 5 months ago, I would have told you, you know, that the most important thing that I do is to sit and apply bum glue. Have you heard of it? Bum glue, it's a really good product. It's mm-hmm. glue that you put onto your bum and then it forces you to sit. I'm entertaining myself. Basically, for a few years now, I had lots of bum glue, and have you read Stephen Pressfield's books?
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing author. What are some of his titles?
There's The War of Art, Turning Pro, Do the Work. All of them are. Those are mandatory reading, I think, for anybody to build a creative career.
I agree. So he's amazing, and he helped me through his writing. And again, I think probably The War of Art is the first one to begin with. Just so good. He helped me with realizing that there is this inner resistance and that I will never feel like it's the right time to be creative. One of the things that I've learned is that focusing and talking a lot about routine and about what I've learned is that it's not the most important thing, because I really like, you know, to organize my calendar and to have 15 minutes of meditation and then half an hour of walking and then 17 minutes of visualization and then 5 minutes of prayer and then eating and then running and then exercising. And I really like all of that. But I also know that when I am dedicating myself to a project, to a book or whatever, I try to let it sweep me. I try to let it, take control over my life. And that would be, my answer as far as routine goes, to spend as much time with bum glue as possible. And when I was painting, and I would paint like 5 or 10 paintings, or sometimes even 14 paintings at the same time. So over a period of several months, I would complete like 14 paintings. I really regarded myself as a small factory. A factory of one man. And it wasn't bum glue, but it was like brush glue. I would have to have the brush in my hand. Mm-hmm. And it's so tempting to have the cell phone in my hand instead. But just to have this mandatory... I'm going to use difficult words or harsh words, but it's really like raping yourself. It's like really forcing yourself to face resistance, look this inner urge to do anything but the thing that you know that you need to do and to look it straight in the eye, which is very frightening, and to just say, I'm going to write right now. And then I sit down and write, and I think that what I'm writing is the most despicable text ever written. It's badly written. It was written before, better by someone else. Why am I even writing it? Who am I to attempt writing a book about Gandhi? Who am I to attempt, you know, English isn't my first language and I'm writing in English. Oh my God, this sentence was just an epic fail. And that would be the thing that I would experience. But nevertheless, I would still keep working and I would try and have the internet turned off and the world turned off and work. And yeah, up about until 4 months ago, that would have been my answer. In the past 4 months, I feel like God or the universe or intuition is trying to channel something through me. And I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I've been spending now 4 months writing lots and lots of stuff in my notebook and walking in nature. Being totally unproductive as far as, you know, my previous metrics and my previous ways of measuring productivity. So that's what I've been up to in the past 4 months, and we'll see where that leads me to. So who knows?
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really sort of beautiful and fitting end to our conversation. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
It makes something or someone or something unmistakable? I'm going to ask you back a question, okay?
Yeah.
Give me one or two words that you would use as synonyms for unmistakable.
I think distinctive is the first one that comes to mind, or different or outstanding in some way.
Okay, so you're using unmistakable as a positive mm-hmm. word, right? Like an outlier, yeah?
Sure. Yeah.
Service, a commitment to service. When someone says that something is trying to manifest itself through them. So when an activist or when a creative person understands that this painting wants to be giving birth by this person, and that it's not about the ego of this creative person, but it's about what this painting can do to others and how this book can serve others, how this social campaign can help someone, how this change in the perception of education can help someone, how this new product can help people. So focusing on that can really transcend someone from being average or mediocre to be unmistakably successful. And that's something that I try to remind myself constantly. And that is that it's not about me. It's not about Jonathan Kislev and about his ego and about his fears. It's about what this book, this painting, this social campaign can do for others. And that makes a person unmistakable. Yay!
Amazing. You're not disappointed me. This has easily been one of my favorite conversations I've had on the podcast all year long. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
I would go to amazon.com/author/Kislev, KISLEV, or just write on Google Jonathan Kislev, KISLEV, usually with a hyphen in between. So KIS-LEV, and you'll be able to find lots and lots of stuff about me.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming. Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.